He looked at her without recrimination, without adding one tiny stick of kindling to the shame that already threatened to burn her at the stake. She'd never hit Trevor. Promised herself she never would. And then, to make matters worse, so unequipped was she to deal with her own shame that she spun on her heels and left him alone. The smoke made her eyes burn, like it did every working night of her life, like it had since the truck had come home alone and unusable, unsaleable, but still fully financed. Conway Twitty blasted on the jukebox, which she didn't like one bit, and which, relieved only by loud voices and the clinking of beer bottles, seemed to add to her already foul mood. The sound of bottles, the smell of beer, it was one tiny step from all she could take every night. Now and then she'd get a whiff of it, taste that first cold slug in her mouth, so real, so clear, without ever meaning to imagine it, without any warning whatsoever. 20 days it had been, and every night seemed harder than the night before. Half the time she'd call Bonnie at 3 a.m., wake her out of a sound sleep, and Bonnie would say, "Girl, quit that damn job." But that was easy for Bonnie to say, because where was Arlene supposed to find another one? Frustrating as all hell it was, the whole deal, and she hated herself like crazy for taking it out on her boy. Hitting might have been in her blood now, like a dog who's killed his first chicken and so acquired the taste. Because every time that loud redneck with a beard and tattoos leaned out of his booth and patted her butt, the back of her hand wanted to forget itself one more time. Only this time it would be wonderful. And he did it every time she passed his booth. Her eyes kept darting to the clock, hoping for a moment free to call Trevor before he fell asleep. But that moment wouldn't seem to come. And if one more time she had to scream to be heard over the din, if one more time she had to ask for an order to be screamed again, only to hear it no better than the time before, well, she just didn't know what she would do. She wanted to know what she would do, but really, there was nothing. Years ago, maybe then, options was not such a useless word. But now there is the boy to think about. Suicide, homicide, telling the boss to shove it. They were all off the menu for years, maybe forever. Still, she could have gotten by on one job if not for that damn truck. And then she screwed up the order for table 9. Bud Coors, what the hell was the big difference anyway for a table of slobs too drunk to taste? She sidled up behind Maggie, said she was taking 5, bad timing or no. She hated to work with Maggie, nice a girl as she was, helpful and sweet as she was, because Maggie was a big, horsey girl, built funny, whom nobody wanted to pinch, leaving more insult for Arlene to duck and bear. She used the phone in the kitchen, an overwhelming freeway of body traffic, usually the same few bodies, none of whom seemed to mind the shimmery heat over the fryer or the smell of hot grease near as much as she did. Trevor picked up on the 4th ring, right before her cardiac arrest set in. "Honey, you okay?"
"Sure, Mom. I'm always okay."
"Were you asleep?"
"Well, not yet. I'll go in a minute, though. I was reading that World War II book."
"Trevor, I'm so sorry. I mean, I am just so, so sorry. I mean, I'm so ashamed that I hit you. I just cannot say." She paused, hoping for something, anything that would relieve her of the duty to continue.
"If there's ever anything I can do to make it up, anything at all."
"Well?" "Anything."
"I don't think you'd go for it."
"Anything."
"Will you take me to visit Jerry?"
"Wow. That big, huh? Don't you hate moments like this," she'd said to Jerry, "where it seems that we're all pretty much the same?" No, Jerry liked them. Apparently another moment Arlene hated was on its way home. The kind in which you see the person who let you down bad really messed up everything, and right there in his eyes is you. All you see is the same disappointment and stress you know yourself. Nothing to explain how a well-intentioned person could cause all that harm. Like when Ricky came around after reconciling with his wife, Cheryl. A hateful, miserable thing to do, and he looked like the same man around the eyes, only a little more tired, a little more worried and beaten down.
"Do you even know where he is, honey?" We could find out. Okay, okay, I will. But I gotta get back to work now, Trevor. You be a good boy. Brush your teeth. Mom!
And Arlene hung up quickly, saved from having to admit she treated him like a 3-year-old every time she left him alone at night. The swinging kitchen door opened at the strike of her shoulder, open to the sound of Randy Travis too loud and the smell of beer and sweaty men too strong. Hours too long, paychecks too small, never enough sleep. Just hold on till 3, Arlene. And then, in the wake of that wisdom, try not to notice that it's an impossible world away. And when and if it ever does come, it will only lead to tomorrow, another working day. Another no-beer day. The woman in the front cubicle of the county jail wore her blood-red nails so long she had to type with the eraser end of a pencil. She sat with her legs crossed in a tight short skirt, chewing her gum with clicking sounds Arlene found irritating. Arlene tightened her grip on Trevor's shoulder.
Name?
Arlene McKinney.
And you here to visit?
Jerry Bisconi.
Can I see some ID, please?
Arlene slid her driver's license across the counter, which she hated to do because the picture made her look so bad. In fact, she thought the woman might have smirked a tiny bit at her expense, though she knew she probably imagined the slight after all.
Wait in there, please,
the woman said, sliding the license back and gesturing with one amazing nail. It seemed like a simple enough request, until Arlene tried and discovered that she and Trevor would not wait alone, as she had imagined, but in a room filled with dirty children, a snoring old man with his mouth open, women with ankle bracelets, real or tattooed, teeth stained with tobacco and eyes stained bloodshot with disillusionment, and shy women who looked at the floor as if waiting to be hit, with fussy babies and runny-nosed toddlers. And no more chairs. But a promise is just that. So she stood with Trevor in a corner, clutching at his sleeve, and wondered if these people would think Jerry was her husband, and if so, why she minded so much that they would. 10 minutes ticked by, each feeling like a day. Then they were allowed into a room with a long table, a long line of chairs, plexiglass dividers, and telephones. Just like in the movies. Men in two-piece orange suits filed in on the other side, picked up their phones, and women cried and held their hands to the glass, just like in the movies. A few more long minutes. No new prisoners. No Jerry. Just more waiting. More holding Trevor's arm, maybe tightly enough to hurt. A guard shuffled by behind the divider. Behind the row of men Arlene wished were not so familiar around the eyes. She leaned forward and tapped on the glass, and the uniformed man picked up the phone.
Problem?
What happened to Jerry Bisconi?
He's not coming out.
What do you mean he's not coming out? My son and I came all the way down here to visit him.
Can't make him take a visitor. Said he wasn't in the mood.
Wasn't in the mood? Jerry Bisconi wasn't in the mood to see the boy who was always in the mood to give him all the proceeds of his own hard after-school work. Mood, it takes. That's rich. Yeah, that's a good one. Can I leave a note?
Front desk.
Thanks. Jerry, I cannot bring myself to say dear, because right at the moment you are not dear to me at all. I can forgive you for getting busted because we all screw up, and I am no exception. But this little boy who helped you and counted on you came down here to see how you were, and you were not in the mood, which I think makes you 18 different kinds of chicken shit. It's always easy to get mad on his behalf. In fact, it's sort of a specialty of mine, but truth is, I'm mad at what you did to me, too. Telling me all your hopes and dreams so I couldn't not like you, because this would be a whole lot easier if I had never liked or trusted you, but you have taken even that small comfort away from me. I don't trust many people, and then when I make an exception, seems it's always the wrong one. Get your sorry butt out of this place as soon as you can, and then do what you said you would do for my boy and his school project, which is very important to him. But you won't, I know, because you're a hophead, which I could forgive, because people can change, even though it seems they never do. But if you can't face us today, that says a lot about what you will do later.
I don't believe in shooting stars. And if I ever had, I would not believe in them no more. And that is what you have done to this family. Think about that while you're doing prison laundry at the state pen, where they say you're going on the next bus out. My boy would like to write something on this note when I'm done. Which I am. Arlene McKinney.
Hi, Jerry. Hope you're okay and the food is not too terrible. Do you get to watch TV? Will you write me a letter from the state pen? Nobody ever did before. Well, gotta go. Mom's pissed. Your friend, Trevor.
From the Diary of Trevor.
I wonder where people go when they die. They have to go somewhere, right? I mean, it would be just too weird to think about Mrs. Greenberg not being anywhere. That would just be too sad. So, I've decided that she's still out there somewhere, because I've decided I can think whatever I want about it, because I've noticed that everybody thinks something different about it, so I figured that means you can think what you want. Of course, that means I'm going to have to keep that garden real nice. And the cats, jeez, I just thought, somebody's going to have to keep feeding all those wild cats. I wonder how much cat food costs. Anyway, you know what? Even this way, it's still sad.
Chapter 9. Reuben. He'd been in this house for 3 months, but nothing was unpacked. Almost nothing. The big bed was set up, made, and comfortable, so he spent a lot of time on it, grading papers, eating off his lap, and watching the news. He made his way through the sea of boxes to the kitchen, took a small carton of ice cream out of the freezer, and proceeded to eat standing up, right out of the carton, with a plastic spoon, the cat weaving around and through his legs. It made him feel lonely. But then, so did unpacking. The phone rang and proved difficult to find. It was Trevor.
Is it okay that I called you at home? I got the number from information.
Is something wrong, Trevor?
Yeah.
Are you in some kind of trouble? Is your mother there?
Oh, it's nothing like that. I'm okay. It's just my project. It's not going so good at all. It just got a lot worse. Something bad happened. Can I talk to you about it?
Of course you can, Trevor.
Good. Where do you live?
Reuben hadn't expected that. He let the receiver slip down and looked around.
Maybe I can meet you somewhere, Trevor, like the park or the library.
It's okay. I'll ride my bike over. Where do you live?
So Reuben gave him the address, on Rosita, just off San Anselmo, thinking as he did that this was not the 50s, where public trust was such that a student could go into a teacher's home without anyone getting a crazy and wrong idea. But he had not thought it through fast enough or well enough, because Trevor was off the phone and on his way. They could talk on the front porch. To be extra safe, he called Trevor's mother, who was listed in the phone book, to explain where Trevor was and why. She wasn't home, and Reuben had no idea if she worked on Saturdays, but he left a message on her answering machine, just in case. Then he looked down and realized he was in sweats and unshaven. He managed to change into clean jeans and a white shirt and shave before Trevor arrived. It didn't take very long. He grew beard only on the right side of his face. Trevor dumped his bike on its side on Reuben's lawn. Reuben realized he had never seen Trevor upset, so far as he knew. He stood on the bottom porch step in khaki shorts and a 49ers t-shirt.
Mrs. Greenberg died.
Oh, I'm so sorry, Trevor, he said, offering the boy a straight-backed chair on the porch. Come sit down, tell me about her. Who she was to you?
She was from my project. She was like my last chance.
Then he stopped himself, as if ashamed, and took the chair offered him.
Oh, that didn't sound right. I didn't mean I was upset about my project. I mean, when she died and all. It's not that. It's both. I mean, she really was going to pay it forward. She told me. And then she died. I went over to her house this morning. I always take the paper right up to her door. But the last couple of days, it's like she's not home. But she's always home. So today was Saturday, so I just waited. And then the mailman came, and he said she hadn't taken the mail out of her box for 3 days. He said her monthly check was in there, and it wasn't like her not to get it right away. So then we knocked on her neighbor's door, and they called her son, and he came over and opened the door, and she was in bed, just like she was sleeping, only she wasn't sleeping. She was dead.
Trevor stopped for a breath. This was a difficult moment for Reuben. Any moment that required him to be emotionally helpful, to offer solace or understanding, was a hard moment. Not that he didn't have any, just getting it from the inside of himself to the inside of someone else, that was the tricky part. "I'm sorry, Trevor. That must have been hard for you."
"The project is almost due. Jerry got sent to the state pen. He wouldn't even come out when we went to visit. And my mom still thinks my daddy's going to come back. The whole thing is a bust, Mr. St. Clair."
"I'm not sure I follow the part about your mother." He halfway did, but hoped Trevor might elaborate.
"Well, it doesn't matter. But what am I going to do for my project?"
Reuben shook his head. It hurt to watch the idealism get kicked out of somebody, almost as much as it had hurt when he'd lost his own. "I guess you just report your effort. I'm grading on effort, not results."
"I wanted results."
"I know you did, Trevor." He watched the boy pick at a seam on the cuff of his shorts.
"I didn't just want a good grade. I really wanted the world to get better."
"I know you did. It's a tough assignment. That's part of its lesson, I'm afraid. We all want to change the world, and sometimes we need to learn that it's harder than we think."
"I really do feel bad about Mrs. Greenberg, though. She was a nice lady. I don't think she was really old. I mean, sort of old, but not that old. We used to talk."
Reuben looked up to see an old green Dodge Dart pull up to the curb and Arlene McKinney step out. It twisted into an already sore place in his gut to see her unexpectedly. She was the closest he'd come to a date in years, a failed attempt at romance. But he'd never intended to put himself in that position, and neither had she. It hadn't been a real date. But now the awkwardness was real. He watched her march up the walkway, up the steps to his porch, purpose plastered on to cover human frailty, all outward confidence. And it struck him then, for the first time, how much alike they really were. "I know you don't like me," she'd said. "I know you're looking down on me." So there it was. He acted defensive toward her because he assumed she found him ugly. She acted defensive toward him because she assumed he found her stupid. It was such a stunning moment, he wanted to share it with her. In that split second, he felt he might have been able to communicate this realization, if they'd been alone. He couldn't remember the last time he'd seen himself in someone else. It changed him, this simple observation. Like being jostled off the edge of a tall building, causing him to wonder if it was too late to get his old isolation back.
"Now, Trevor," she said, "I bet Mr. St. Clair's got better things to do than to hear about your troubles on a nice Saturday morning like this one. You can talk to me, you know. You weren't home."
Trevor studied his scuffed high tops. "I didn't mind, Miss McKinney, really. I just wanted you to know where he was."
"Well, I thank you for that, but we'll just be going now."
She motioned with a hand to her son, who followed her off the porch obediently. "Arlene?" He hadn't known he was about to call her back, had never intended to use her first name. She must have been surprised, too. She spun around, looked at him for the longest time, really looked at him, as though seeing something she hadn't seen before. Which she was. And it made him uncomfortable to feel so transparent.
"Trevor, wait for me in the car,"
she said quietly, and rejoined Reuben on the porch. She stood strangely close. Reuben's chest felt heavy with the expectancy of the moment. The notion that he could express his revelation was now gone. Still, he had no choice but to try.
"When you first met me, and you thought I was looking down my nose at you, I just want you to know something."
She waited patiently, face slightly turned up to him. She reflected a pleasant expectance. She didn't dislike him. She just wanted him to like her. It was right there on her face.
"I have a hard time meeting people. I'm very sensitive about... well, I tend to think I repel people. I mean, I do, but I was being defensive. That's what I'm trying to say. I wasn't looking down on you. I was being defensive because I thought you were looking down on me."
"Really?"
A skinless, unguarded question.
"Really?"
"Well, thank you. That's nice.
She moved to the porch rail, glanced at the car and her waiting son.
No, really, that's nice. I appreciate that you told me that. It's kind of funny, really. I mean, here we are being all cold to each other. You don't think I'm dumb, really?
Not at all.
I don't talk good like you. Oh, talk well, I mean. I could, I guess. I know how to talk right. I just sort of got out of the habit. Maybe you could come over for dinner again some night.
Maybe.
Maybe? Reuben felt surprised to hear himself say it. Maybe. Actually, he'd wanted to say no. Now that she had turned her eyes up to him, hopeful and childlike, flattered to win his approval, he could not get far enough away from her. She stared at him for a moment, then marched purposefully back to her car and drove off without comment. So, there it is, Reuben thought, his mind caught in a brand of resigned irony. There it was. There it goes. What a relief to know that nothing ever really changes. From The Other Faces Behind the Movement.
My friend Lou from Cincinnati was gay. We'd go out for a beer and talk sometimes in the evening about our respective problems. Lou's problem was he had a bad habit of falling for guys who were not. Gay, that is. And my problem was I tended to be, what's the word I'm searching for? Picked up, befriended, latched onto by attractive women who liked me and found me safe. Safe. That's just how every lonely, sexually deprived man wants a woman to see him, right? Safe. They'd ask me out to movies, to dinner, exactly like dating. If it differed in any way from dating, I'd like someone to explain how. At the end of the evening, I'd get a kiss on the cheek. Always the same cheek. The hormones would rage. In me, that is. And right around the time I was hopelessly, relentlessly in love and having trouble hiding it, she would say something along the lines of, "Oh, I like you as a friend, Reuben. We have such a nice friendship. Let's not spoil it." Nice women in most cases. So I had to assume they had no idea how cruel they had been. Because if any one of them had been monster enough to do that much damage on purpose, I think I would have known. Anyway, Lou and I tipped a few one night. I didn't even know he was gay at the time. I told him the easiest stories to tell, older, less painful. The kind you can laugh at just a little because those years to come have already come. "You have no idea how that feels," I said, not realizing who I was saying it to. Nobody does. To have that depth of emotion for someone and to know that they would find your feelings utterly repulsive. And Lou laughed and ordered another beer and told me a story of his own. And then I knew. And I knew as well that he knew how it felt. "Why straight guys?" I asked. He shrugged. "I don't know. There are just so damn many more of them." I got quiet for a long time, and then I said, "Lou, you didn't mean me, did you? You weren't saying you had those feelings about me." Not that I would have been repelled if he had. I certainly wouldn't have stopped being his friend, but I need to know, to be sure I wasn't being insensitive without realizing. "Hell no, Rube," he said. "You're way too ugly for me. I think we should just be friends." Well, good. That would have been utterly repulsive. We got to laughing then, and the sound of his laughter when he got going was so funny and silly it made me laugh just to hear it. I'd try to stop it just when I'd get it under control. He'd break up again, we'd go for another round. And then we fell serious. Just like that. And I was so tired. More tired than I'd ever been in my life, and I wanted to go home. As if all of a sudden I realized, it's not so goddamn funny. That should have been a safe, comfortable end to everything, but the following Thursday evening he ran into her at the market, just dropped into a longish line with his ice cream and his TV dinners, and found himself looking at the back of her head. It seemed to Reuben as though one could look at the back of someone else's head quietly without being noticed,
But apparently he did it wrong because she immediately turned around.
"Oh, you,"
she said. And that was it. She turned back and they both waited in excruciating silence, watching Terry and Matt scan and bag groceries as if finding their simple movements fascinating. She looked briefly over her shoulder at Reuben on her way out of the store. Then she was gone, and he breathed deeply, a man just having found his way to safety from grave and immediate danger. He found her in the parking lot, leaning on his car.
"You know what your problem is?"
she said. It was the old Arlene, and it felt good to Reuben to have her back, that little lightning bolt of indignation all ready to read him the riot act about one thing or another.
"No, I don't. What is my problem?"
"Your problem is, you're so quick to think nobody wants you, you don't even give them a chance. I couldn't reject you if I tried. You're too fast for me."
"Well, thank you, Arlene. That was very informative."
He moved for his driver's door, and she peeled away, out of his trajectory, as he knew she would. He set his groceries on the passenger seat, got in, and slammed the door. But she wasn't gone. She stood by his window as he fired up the little engine, and before he could drive away, she tapped on the glass. He rolled the window halfway down.
"So," she said, "you want to go out or what?"
"Yes and no."
"What the hell kind of an answer is that?"
"The honest kind. What do you want me to say?"
"I want you to say I'm not doing anything on Sunday night, Arlene. Maybe you and me could take in a movie or something."
Reuben sighed. He put the Volkswagen in gear, popped it out again.
"Arlene, would you like to go to a movie this Sunday?"
He didn't mean it to, but it came out sounding petulant, like a little boy who's just been ordered to apologize when he wasn't feeling one bit sorry.
"Yes, I would. But I bet I'm going to be sorry I ever started with this."
"I'll put a couple of dollars on that, too," Reuben said.
But he was half a block away before he said it. Chapter 10 Arlene Loretta sat in Arlene's kitchen, drinking coffee and brushing tons of thick blonde hair back from her forehead. Arlene figured if she had that much hair, she'd fool around with it too, but she never would. And also that she could be a blonde just as easy as Loretta, but would prefer to go along with what nature intended. Arlene said,
"Did I mention he's black?"
Loretta said,
"No." "Oh, he's black." "So?" "Well, I don't know. I just mentioned it." "Do you care?" "I don't know. No, I just mentioned it is all. I told you about his face, though." "More times than I could count. That bothers you." "No, not really. At first, maybe. Could have fooled me. Well, after a while, I just kind of got used to it. I don't think about it much anymore." "But what about when you're, like, close, though? Does it bother you then?"
Arlene jumped out of her chair to wash her cup in the sink, even though half the coffee was still in it, waiting to be drunk. Over her shoulder, she said,
"Well, to be real honest with you, we ain't never been that close." "What about when he kisses you?"
Loretta waited patiently for her answer. In fact, Arlene was surprised by how long it took her to give up.
"You ain't gonna tell me you never kissed him." "I ain't." "You've been out with him 4 times. Don't you think that might start to hurt his feelings after a while?" "Well, I know you won't believe this, Loretta."
She dumped her coffee and sat back down, leaning close and talking low, a girl-type conspiracy.
"It's not me that's holding out." "You're right. I don't believe you. Say, now don't get this question wrong. I ain't dared to ask it yet. What are you dating this guy for anyway? You give up on Ricky?" "Of course not." "Why then?" "Oh, why do you think? How can you even ask me that? It's been over a year, Loretta. Don't you think I got needs? Besides, serves Ricky right if he comes back and I've been with somebody else. It's what he gets."
Loretta rocked back in her chair more dramatically than was absolutely necessary.
"Uh-oh." "Uh-oh what?"
"That's like the worst reason to date a guy I ever heard."
"What is? I didn't say anything about a reason."
"'Cause it would serve Ricky right."
"Hypothetically speaking." "So, this guy's just for sex in the meantime?" "Yeah. I know how guys just hate that."
Some guys might hate it.
Not no guy I ever met.
Arlene looked up suddenly to see Trevor standing in the kitchen doorway.
Trevor, how long you been standing there? I just woke up. Don't sneak up on a body like that. I just came for breakfast. Get on out and play, would you? I haven't had my breakfast. Oh, right. Oh, sit down. Let me fix you something.
Trevor shook his head in apparent bewilderment and settled at the table, leaning his chin on both hands. Loretta said,
Well, anyway, can't use a guy for what he won't give you.
Trevor perked up his ears.
Who are you talking about? This don't concern you, Trevor. And Loretta, little pitchers have big ears, if you catch my drift.
Loretta shrugged and refilled her own cup at the Mr. Coffee machine.
Anyway, sounds like a personal problem to me. If I were you, I'd be talking to Bonnie. Nothing to talk about, Loretta. Just drop it.
She set two toaster waffles in front of her boy, then ran down the hall and called Bonnie on the bedroom phone. The machine picked up, and Arlene left a message saying she had a personal problem she'd like to discuss. She cut her way through Bonnie's little double-wide mobile home, through knick-knacks and home crafts and needlepoint and feathers and pottery and blown glass and porcelain clowns. Bonnie liked things and kept plenty of them around the house so things would never be in short supply. Arlene made herself comfortable on the soft couch in a nest of embroidered pillows. Bonnie said,
So, you finally quit the damn laser lounge?
Yeah, guy come and bought the engine off me for $800, so I got 2 months ahead on the payments.
And in 2 months, then what?
Cross that bridge when I come to it. At least I'll get caught up on my sleep before I gotta worry. That's not what I come to talk about.
How can you be having relationship problems? I thought we said no relationships in your first year.
Arlene sighed and studied the ceiling.
Well, I'm sorry, Bonnie, but for one time, I didn't do what you told me.
For one time?
Bonnie's sharp voice cut the air like a siren. If there had been dogs in the yard, Arlene figured they'd howl along. But there were no dogs allowed in Bonnie's mobile home park.
Girl, where'd you learn to count? You don't never do what I told you. What about Ricky?
You see him around here?
No, but what if we do?
Cross that bridge when we come to it, too.
In other words, just go on a spending spree and worry about the bills when they get in.
I didn't say that.
That's what I heard. So, what's the problem?
Well, I've been out with this guy 4 times. He hasn't even tried to touch me. He's just like a complete gentleman.
You poor girl. Men are such beasts.
4 times, though, Bonnie. Doesn't it seem off to you?
You never got to know a guy before you jumped in the sack?
Actually, Arlene thought, no. But she didn't care to say that.
He hasn't so much as tried to hold my hand. What's that sound like to you?
Sounds like the guy's got more sense than you do. Not like that's the hardest contest in the world to win. No offense. Look, you ain't got but 60 days sober. No time to be adding sex to more immediate problems, but if you're going to do it anyway, and I know you are, for God's sake, take it slow.
I guess.
Girl, you hear one word I say to you?
I'm just so damn sick and tired of sleeping alone, Bonnie. Damn tired of it, too. And I know he is, too. So what's so terrible? I mean, what's his problem?
You're asking me?
Yeah, that's why I come all the way over here. I'm asking you.
Doesn't that strike you a little odd, to be asking me?
You're my sponsor.
So, I'm supposed to know what this guy's thinking that I never even met.
You mean, ask him?
Bonnie let out a big, indefinable noise and threw her hands up in a gesture of defeat.
And she thinks she's ready to have a relationship. Lord, help us all.
Then she walked Arlene to the door, since Arlene was going that way anyway, with or without help.
Hey, this is the guy you told me about with the scars?
Yeah.
You sure he knows you want him to?
Well, sure he knows. I mean, he must. What would I be going out with him for if I didn't want him to?
You better make sure he knows. Don't tell nobody I said that. You're supposed to get a year sober first.
Yeah, but you knew I wouldn't.
Bonnie rolled her eyes and slammed the door shut. Made her feel like a kid, the way she had to corner him at her own front door as if her parents were waiting up inside. Problem was, Reuben always paid for a babysitter. Well, It wasn't a problem. It was real nice, but it was part of the problem, because if she invited him in, well, there the girl would be, and she didn't have a car, so Reuben had to drop her home. Arlene hadn't quite figured a way around that. So when he walked her to her door, which he always did, being a gentleman, she slid up to him and put her arms around his neck.
"I had a real nice time tonight,"
she said quietly into his right ear. The muscles in his neck and shoulders felt tight. She waited for him to say the same, or to say anything, or to relax, or put his hands on her back. But there they hung at his sides while he said nothing at all.
"How come you're so tense?"
"Do I seem tense?"
"Am I making you nervous? You want me to stop?"
"I guess I have mixed feelings about it."
Discouraged as she'd been, that seemed like a good jumping-off place to Arlene, who figured mixed feelings to be better than no feelings at all. She took two steps to push up a little closer, but he yielded and ended up with his back against the door. Since he couldn't go anywhere from there, she kissed him. It didn't feel different from kissing anybody else. It was a soft kiss. She didn't know why, since she seemed to be leading and had never felt a soft kiss before. And it brought up all these soft feelings in her stomach, like little breaths trying to get out, only more fluttery. She really hadn't expected to like it nearly that much. She drew back to look at him, figuring this was the moment to find out one way or another if it bothered her. But he turned his head a little, and she found herself looking mostly at the right side of his face, which was handsome and pleasant anyway. She'd always thought so.
"You finally coming in tonight?"
It was a hard question to ask, because she'd convinced herself she wouldn't have to sleep alone that night, even though she knew she might be wrong. And if she was wrong, she preferred not to know it yet.
"I have to drive the babysitter home."
"You could come back."
"But Trevor's in the house."
She still was mostly pressed against him while they discussed it, with her arms around his neck, listening to the change in his voice and watching opportunities to respond pass him by.
"That kid sleeps like the dead. You couldn't wake him up if you tried. Once, when we lived in Paso Robles, the house next door burned to the ground. Sirens in the middle of the night, people yelling. I had to take him out to the street in a fireman's carry, and he just hung there on my shoulders, sleeping. Don't you worry about Trevor." "I'm talking too much, aren't I?"
He smiled, which she found encouraging, so she kissed him again.
"So, you'll come back, right?"
"Arlene, I'm not sure."
She put a finger to his lips before she had to find out what he wasn't sure of.
"Don't you get tired of sleeping alone?"
"Of course I do."
"Don't you feel that way about me?"
He slipped out of her grasp and slid around toward the stairs.
"Oh, God," he said. "Is that what you think?"
So he did feel that way about her, but had to get farther away to tell her so.
"You're like a saint, right? And that's how you got that name, Saint Reuben."
"No, you have no idea how much of a saint I'm not. If you could spend 1 minute inside my skin, you'd know."
"So, come back."
She took his hand, afraid to lose him before he answered. And he said he would. From The Other Faces Behind the Movement.
"Oh, I'm such a jerk. It was right there to see. It's only 5 minutes to the babysitter's and five back again, but fool that I am, it took me an hour to figure out he wasn't coming back. It was a bad hour, too, because I minded a lot that he didn't. More than I wanted to or expected to. Loretta said I'm so used to guys pawing all over me that the more he wouldn't, the more I wished he would. I don't know. I'm not big on psychology. She made it sound like a sickness, like I only wanted what I couldn't get. Maybe I just liked how he didn't treat me cheap. Maybe I just liked being around a gentleman for a change. But then, sitting there, thinking about all the things I was starting to like about him, it just got harder and harder the more he didn't come back. I ended up sitting in the living room watching for his car down the street. Every time I heard a motor, I'd get this little flutter in my stomach, and every time it drove on by, I'd feel a cry right behind my eyes.
I had to work real hard not to let it have its way. Funny how sometimes I'd get involved with a guy because I thought somehow, for some reason, with some particular guy, it wouldn't hurt that much. Funny, I still thought it'd work after all that time, because it never had before. Finally, I gave up and called his house. He answered the phone by saying, "I'm sorry, Arlene, I really am." And I said, "So that's it then? It's just never going to be that way?" I was almost crying, and I know he could hear it in my voice because I could. I hate that. He said, "Couldn't you just give me a little more time?" I said, "Yeah, I guess I probably could if that's what the situation required. But one thing for damn sure, I was getting a new babysitter, and this one had to have her own car." He laughed when I said that. I was glad he did. It always helps to laugh at a time like that. And if he hadn't, I might never have figured out that he was scared to death. I guess I can be slow about these things. So we're having this nice laugh together, and the next thing I know, I'm crying. Full on, no point trying to hide it. I know, I'm too emotional. Everybody tells me that. If Bonnie had been there, she'd have told me that's the perfect example of how I wasn't ready, but thank God she was not. "Arlene," he said, "are you all right?" And I said, "Damn it, I just hate to sleep alone so much. You'd think I'd be good at it by now. I get scared and lonely at night, and I just never get no sleep. I quit my night job so I could sleep for a change, but that only made it worse. More time to lie there scared and lonely. Sometimes I think I'll get up and go on back there just to make the night go by." I don't know if he followed the half of that, though, because when I get to crying, it's hard to understand most of what I say. He was quiet for a minute. Well, not a minute, but it seemed that long. Then he said, "Do you want me to come over to your house just to sleep?" And I said, "You know, that would be very nice, because I sort of got it in my head you might be here tonight. Give me 10 minutes." That was the last thing he said. After I hung up the phone, I crossed over to the window and looked out through the trees at this thin little crescent moon hanging yellow over the hill, and smiled because it was nice of him to offer, even though I knew he wouldn't show. Once bitten, you know. But that man was all full of surprises. I learned not to try to guess him out after a while.
She'd given up and put herself to bed when she heard his quiet knock. She put on a robe and let him in. Well, opened the door to let him in, but he seemed to get stuck there on the threshold. She had to take his hand and give a little pull. She wanted to offer a hug, but it seemed if she went forward, he might go backward, since he always had before. She turned and walked into the bedroom, hoping he would follow, hardly daring to turn around to see if he did. She dropped her robe on the floor, not really thinking in advance how he'd feel about that, the way she slept with nothing on, even if it was just for sleeping. When she looked over her shoulder, he was standing there in her bedroom doorway, watching. The lights were all off, so it was dark, except for that little thin sliver of yellow moon. And she didn't figure he could see much more than just the smoky outline of her pulling back the covers, settling in way over to one side to give him plenty of room. In time, he came around to the other side of the bed and lay down on his back on top of the covers. He was wearing jeans and a white shirt, and she hadn't seen him in jeans since that day she went by his house. When he came by to take her out, he always dressed nice, with a tie and everything. She rolled a little closer and rested her head on his shoulder. After a few minutes more in silence, she said,
"Do you want me to take off my earrings? Are they digging into you?"
She had three pieces on that side and didn't want him to be uncomfortable, figuring he would never say if he was. "No, I can't even feel them." It was the first he'd spoken since coming into her house. His voice sounded low and careful.
"Thanks for coming back, Reuben."
"Why are you doing this? And don't say because you hate to sleep alone. I'm sure there are plenty of men who'd like to be here with you tonight.
Got any other phone numbers?
Is it because Trevor wanted us together?
Oh, damn, Reuben. Just how far do you think I'll go to help that kid with his homework, huh?
Why me, then?
Arlene sat up.
You know what your problem is?
No, but fortunately I have you to tell me.
Your problem is you worry too much about your looks. I don't care near as much as you do. I couldn't possibly. Even if I quit my day job, I just wouldn't have time. Did you ever consider that if you'd never gone and gotten hurt like you did, you'd be way too good for me? I mean, you'd be in such a whole different league, you wouldn't even give me the time of day.
Nobody's out of your league, Arlene. You're too pretty.
There's more to this league thing than just looks.
Good thing for me, if that's true.
There was a bigger side to the story for her, but no words in which to frame it. It wouldn't make sense to him, probably, or even ring true if she said she liked him because he picked her up, wearing a tie, paid for a babysitter, took her to a nice restaurant, and then walked her to her door. How do you explain to a guy that, until you met him, you didn't know you'd been getting a raw deal?
She set her cheek back down on his shoulder and threw one arm across his chest. A big, solid chest, she thought. The kind that wards off evil spirits in the dark.
Don't take this the wrong way, but wouldn't you be more comfortable out of those clothes?
He didn't answer straight off. In fact, she thought he probably never would. Then he said,
"Maybe next time. Maybe tomorrow."
And she was so relieved to think he'd be there again tomorrow. She didn't say another word, not wanting to say or do anything that might break that spell.
Chapter 11. Matt.
The store closed at 9, and he wasted no time breaking for the door. Three times when he checked the clock, he'd been sure it was broken, but another minute had eventually ticked away. Not for any special reason did the time go so slowly. Not much more than usual. Work always crawled by. He parked his motorcycle behind the shop on the hill. It made so much noise, and the owner always gave him a dirty look if he idled it too close to the store. It didn't have an electric starter. Or rather, the one it had didn't work. So he had to kick it over. And it didn't have a neutral light, so he had to rock it back and forth a bit to make sure it wasn't in gear. Which was hard on the hill. Hard to coast it. Hard to be sure. Thinking it was in neutral, he straddled the bike, jumped on the kick lever, and the bike, still in first gear, rolled forward off the side stand and fell with him. Now there'd be another 3 weeks of gas tank-shaped bruise on the inside of his thigh. But that was not the worst of it. Straining to pick the bike up again, Matt saw he'd broken the front brake lever, hit the handlebar and sheared it right off. And the back brake wasn't any too good. He closed his eyes and thought about screaming. But it was a quiet night, the houses in this neighborhood filled with quiet people. Nobody liked trouble. Besides, he'd tried that once. Stood in the street and cussed out the bike, calling it every name he could think of. Hadn't fixed a goddamn thing. He turned the bike around, straddled it again, coasted it down the hill, popped the clutch and roll-started it. If only he'd thought of that to begin with. If only. He ran the stop sign on the Camino because he had to, and nobody noticed. No cops around. So he cruised the Camino at 25, half pulled over to the curb. That way, if he had to stop suddenly, he'd have a fighting chance. Five guys in a low-rider Chevy slowed beside him, rolled down their windows, called him a pussy, asked if he needed training wheels. It was a worse day than most, but not in a whole different ballpark. Only thing Matt hated more than going to work was going home and listening to the fighting. He had a tent in the overgrown backyard for when things got really bad. At 19, he knew he needed a place of his own, but it was not that easy. Everybody wanted first and last month's rent. Nobody wanted to pay more than $4.25 an hour for anybody who was anything teen. He pulled into his driveway, cut the engine, put the bike up on the center stand. From out there, he could already hear it. But he went inside all the same. Everybody's got to be somewhere. And Matt was home. Then he saw the letter on the dining room table. He never got mail. And it was from someone he'd never heard of. Ida Greenberg. Weird. a big, thick envelope. Pages and pages mailed to him from Ida Greenberg. Whoever she was. From The Other Faces Behind the Movement.
You know what's weird? What's weird is when you mean a lot more to somebody else than they ever meant to you. I mean, a whole lot more. Like life on two whole different planets. I've been on the wrong end of that, too. My freshman year in high school, I was like head over heels in love with this girl. Her name was Laura Furley. I used to lie in bed at night saying that name to myself over and over in my head. I had this pencil in my drawer that she dropped in the hall. I had it in this little box with tissue paper. I mean, it was weird. It was like a goddamn shrine or something. And I got three pictures of her out of the yearbook and put them in a frame. I never said a word to her. I mean, not even hello. I'm not even sure I ever looked her in the eye. But I wanted to spend my whole life with her. And if I couldn't, I thought I'd spend my whole life thinking about how I couldn't. And then sometimes I would think, if she knew all this, boy, would she be amazed. Probably she would have said, Matt who? I'm not saying I think Mrs. Greenberg was in love with me. It's not that. It's just weird. I mean, I never noticed her any more than any other customer in that store. I just knew her name. I just said, hello, Mrs. Greenberg. How are you tonight? Man, she must have been awful lonely.
Dearest Matthew, if you are reading this, I have passed away. I left this letter and with some personal things with a note to my son, Richard, asking him to mail it after I'm gone. This morning I made some phone calls to my insurance company and to my lawyer. I had to make a very big decision, and I made it. I have a $25,000 life insurance policy, and I decided not to leave it to my son. I don't trust that he would use it the right way. I have decided to split it three ways. $8,333 will go to you, the same amount to Terry, whom I also like very much, and the other third to that nice lady at the cat shelter because she is selfless and does good work. This leaves $1 for Richard. He will kick, and he will be very temperamental. I think you may have to attend the reading of the will, and it may not be pleasant. But I have worked it out carefully with my lawyer. Richard can contest it, and he probably will, but he won't win. We've sealed it all up carefully. You may do what you want with this money, but I'm trusting you to use it well. Not selflessly, just well. Definitely spend it on yourself, but don't waste it. If you want to know why I chose you, it's because you always had a nice smile, and you asked how I was feeling, and then you listened to the answer. You never made me feel like I didn't matter or like I wasn't there. Now, the money is not exactly free. I have done you a big favor. Well, the biggest favor is in my power to do. I know $8,333 doesn't go as far as it used to, but it's all I have. The house is mortgaged up to the hilt, and my Social Security payments expire when I do. Here's what I want you to do. Do a very big favor for three people. It doesn't have to be money. Just give them something that is as big to you as $8,333 is to me. And when they try to pay you back, tell them instead to pay it forward. Give your time if you have to, or your compassion. Lots of people have money, but not that. You are a nice boy. Enjoy the money. Best wishes, Ida Greenberg.
Just a little over 6 weeks later, he had it in his hand. He'd already put a $50 deposit on the apartment so the guy wouldn't rent it to somebody else. He spent the night there in a sleeping bag. He had a decent bed at his folks' house, but no way to move it yet. It was quiet. Real little place. But nice and quiet. When he opened the window, he was right out on the slanting roof, because this apartment used to be an attic once, before somebody divided up the house. And he sat out on the roof in the dark, in the cold, in sweatpants and no shirt, just liking the quiet. What he saw from that roof was trees and nothing else. Just the side of a hill covered with trees, and a sliver of yellow moon gleaming through, which was more than enough. So he sat there for a while, wondering where people go when they die,
and what he could possibly do for somebody else that would mean as much as this $8,333 had meant to him. And what to buy with the rest of the money. And whether Mrs. Greenberg would know. He didn't figure she probably would. It seemed corny to think she was watching. But he'd never known anyone who died. Never thought much about it before. And he wasn't all that completely positive that she wouldn't know. Unlike the $8,333, it wasn't something he could take to the bank. Which made him think about decisions, and whether his were good ones, and how this would change them, not being completely sure if she would know. But it was a long subject to think through and a little unclear, and before he finished, he got cold and sleepy, so he went inside and to bed. The next morning, he drove his old piece of crap motorcycle to the Honda dealer in San Luis Obispo. They said they'd give him $75 in trade. The first thing that caught his eye was a real pretty brand-new 750 with a windshield and all space-age aerodynamic in red and white with a custom paint job. He sat on it. He shouldn't have sat on it. It cost almost $7,000, which was just damn close to all he had left after first and last month's rent and that big security deposit. But damn, it was more than pretty. It was like power. But it was too much. They also had a new 350, like his old one, but 7 model years newer and no miles, and a neutral light and an electric starter. And then, for $3,500, they had a 250 with a nice custom paint job. Brand new. 350, 250. The 250 would go fast enough to ride on the highway, just barely. And if he could go faster, maybe that would just get him a ticket, which he could not afford. Insurance ate up too much of his check as it was. Then he sat on the 750 again, feeling that power. Nobody was going to pull up beside him while he was on this bad boy to talk about training wheels. Ah, but it was too much. It was most of the old lady's money. That was all she had, that insurance. Like someone cashed in her life, and that's what it all added up to. Ah, this was giving him a headache. He rode his old piece of crap to the Taco Bell, had a breakfast burrito, thought some more. Then he went back and bought the 250. And on the way home, stopped at Cuesta College to get a catalog of all their extension classes, and sat on his brand new little bike in the parking lot and leafed through the catalog. And it was so cool because there was no possible combination of classes that he could not afford. He stuck it in his backpack, and the motor started up nice and clean when he hit the button. He took Highway 41, just to feel the curves. So, there. If she could see, she'd know he made a good decision. And if not, well, if not, he could see. He would know he didn't waste it, whether or not Mrs. Greenberg ever found out. From the Diary of Trevor.
Marianne and Arnie have never been very nice to me. Like when I told them I thought Clinton was going to win the election, Arnie hooted and laughed at me. "Bush," he said. "George Bush. Bet on it." Marianne came to school the next day in a cap that said, "Ross for Boss" on the front. "That's how much you know," she said. And I used to have this big old thing for Marianne, too. What was I thinking? Anyway, my mom said to pay them no mind. She told me a story of when she was a kid, and she told her Uncle Harry, who was this big football fan, that Joe Namath and the Jets were going to beat the Colts in the Super Bowl. He laughed at her. Then, when the Jets won, he wouldn't talk about it with her. She said some people just can't handle being wrong. I said, "The Jets and the Colts in the Super Bowl? Man, that must have been like a century ago. Both those teams totally suck now." "Thanks," she said. "Now I feel real old." When I gotta get up and say my project flopped, Marianne and Arnie are gonna give me hell. I sure hope Clinton wins the election.
Chapter 12. Reuben. He woke with a start, fully dressed, on a bed not his own. His eye patch was still on, so he must not have known he had been about to fall asleep. He'd just drifted off for an hour or two, but the sun seemed to be breaking through the east-facing window. He lay still, momentarily too sleepy to identify his surroundings immediately, Someone's fingers were touching the uneven, partly deadened skin on the wrong side of his face. His impulse was to bolt. Then he remembered. Knowing the fingers belonged to Arlene didn't kill the urge.